Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present
Hello and welcome to GIST Radio. We are a casual radio station where we broadcast when we have something to say. GIST stands for Getting Your Shit Together, and we broadcast important interviews and information for artists and creatives of all kinds. For more information on GIST, please log into our website at www.gyst-ink.com, where you will find free resources, software, and publications for artists. You can email us and let us know what you would like to hear about at info@gyst-ink.com. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome to Creative Orange County, the radio show, where we interview Orange County, California's creative stars, artists, entrepreneurs, angel investors, CEOs, nonprofit leaders, and the like. My name is Susan, and I will be your host. We have a beautiful day in Southern California, sunny at 10 o'clock, but it also was at 7, which means it's going to be a gorgeous day, and almost to July 4th, which I can't quite believe that the year is half gone. But my name is Susan, and joining me today is Grace Cook Anderson. And Grace Cook Anderson received her BA in art history in 2000 and her art practice in 2001 from the University of California at Berkeley, and received her MA in curatorial practice in 2007 from the California College of the Arts, San Francisco. Grace was a co-founder of In Situ, a curatorial collaborative, in 2007. Her curatorial projects focus on contemporary art with an emphasis on the investigation of place and social change, and we're going to find out more about that later in the interview. She's with Laguna Art Museum, and at the museum, Grace has curated Osine, 2010, Jeremy Fish, Weathering the Storm, Sean Duffy, Searcher, and currently on display, Lita Albuquerque, Emergence. She is also the curator for Best Kept Secret, UCI, and the Development of Contemporary Art in Southern California, 1964 to 1971. And this exhibit is opening this fall, and it's in conjunction with Getty's Specific Standard Time Initiative, which is a tremendous initiative involving numerous museums and other arts and culture-related spaces from L.A. down to San Diego. So she will tell us all about that upcoming exhibit. So welcome, Grace.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Well, you're very welcome. It's wonderful to have you. Grace, when and how did you decide to become a curator? I mean, why do you do what you do?
I came to curating, or I didn't really know about what a curator did. I came about it a bit slowly. I went into college, really fell in love with art history, and that was my major. And it took me a while. It wasn't until college that I actually started going to museums. I grew up in a very creative household. My dad was a graphic designer, and my mother was creative in every single way possible. And I grew up in that environment, but it wasn't until college, until I was on my own, that I started setting out and visiting museums. And I fell in love with museums, and slowly that's sort of how I learned what curators do. They put these amazing exhibitions together and enlighten viewers and educate the public, and I really fell in love with that. And it was right around the time that I was in college, but I still wasn't quite sure if that was how one gets into being a curator.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked at a gallery. I interned at Sotheby's. I tried a few different things, and it wasn't until I worked at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, I was the assistant to the chief curator, that I realized the museum world was really where I wanted to have a career.
That sounds terrific.
So, yeah, and from that point I was, you know, California College of the Arts at that time had kind of created a new curatorial program. It was sort of the first one on the West Coast to really just emphasize this idea of curatorial practice. And I followed that program from a distance, and when I was ready to enter graduate school, I applied, and I had a really great experience there.
Your curatorial projects, as I read in your bio, focus on contemporary art with an emphasis on the investigation of place and social change. Would you explain, and does that apply to, you know, what you might do as an independent curator, the exhibits that you curate at the Laguna Art Museum, do all of those kind of follow that emphasis?
Well, let's see. This idea, I think, really stemmed from my graduate focus, and I think the class that I was in was really a fairly unique class. We had studied with Matthew Coolidge, who runs the Center for Center for Land Use Interpretation in Culver City, and really, it was looking at the land as a curatable medium, and it really shaped sort of my experience on the idea of curating, and it really expanded my notions of curating. And you know, we also had Will Bradley, who's a writer and a curator, who was really quite influential, and that really kind of shaped my educational experience and thinking about curating. And I've always been interested in this idea of what defines a place. And, you know, it's not just these physical geographies, but it's the social environment, the demographics, all of these things that make up a sort of a place. And I think it was sort of, for me, a way to think about curating in a broader context, not just objects and works of art, but it's everything. It's the whole environment. It's the social context that describes a moment and puts the artwork in a greater context.
And so, does that inform, you know, most of what you curate, that kind of background and that emphasis?
It, you know, it certainly informs the way I think about things and the way I like to do research and the way, you know, the way I like to work independently. But working with a museum, it brings a whole different context. I was really drawn to Laguna Art Museum in my initially when I started in 2008. And I was really quite sort of smitten by the geography and the landscape, and I loved the idea that it was a regional museum, a museum that focused on the art of California. And Laguna Beach, as well, has such a specific identity, and I was really intrigued by that. So I think essentially there, you know, that certainly was a draw for me, that kind of investigation of place. But my role as a curator of exhibitions at the museum, I think, takes on a sort of more general, a general context. But independently, I think my focus is definitely more on looking at social change and place.
Tell me about Noguchi, California Legacy, which is your, you know, which is the correct term, your newest or your latest exhibit?
Yeah, it's our current exhibit. We were fortunate enough to work with the Noguchi Museum in Long Island, and it's the 30th anniversary of California Scenario in Costa Mesa. I don't know if you've visited. Have you been there?
I have not yet because I just I'm just trying to figure out where actually it is, and actually I'm going that way tomorrow, so maybe that would
that's good.
The time.
It's really a hidden gem in Orange County. I mean, it's in Southern California, I would say, and it's it is hard to find because it's sort of tucked away in two buildings. It's behind a restaurant. It's there's not a lot of signage, and I think the fact that it is not so obvious kind of adds to the mystique of it and the beauty of it. But our exhibition here was really to look at Noguchi's brief moment in California. He was born in Los Angeles, but his legacy is really, he's known as an international artist. But in the early 80s, he did spend a brief amount of time working with Henry Segerstrom on California Scenario. He created the Plaza in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. And at that time, he was also working with Gemini GEL, working on these limited edition sculptures. So his moment in California was quite brief but very important. And in some ways, it sort of tied into him sort of essentially coming back home and revisiting the place and the landscape. We have, the exhibition is sort of broken up into sort of three general parts. One is looking at all the ephemera and the materials leading up to California Scenario. And part of that is letters that were exchanged between Noguchi and Henry Segerstrom in his office, and also Noguchi's attempt to there's really funny letters in there, too, where Noguchi wrote to Joshua Park, totally blanking here, the national park, and trying to acquire some rocks in the park.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's right.
His various sort of investigations in, getting different indigenous plants into the landscape and all of that. And the exchange of letters is really great and quite special. I don't think the public has much knowledge on how large public spaces are commissioned and what that's like. So that really kind of shines a light on that experience. And really the exhibition that focuses on California Scenario is kind of the teaser and really just an invitation to visit the actual site, because that's where really the art is really at, and that's where one really has the experience. And then we have a selection of almost all of the sculptures from Gemini GEL that Noguchi worked on, all the limited edition sculptures, and they're quite beautiful. They're steel structures. They're all galvanized steel, and Noguchi describes them as sort of short poems, and they're organic structures that are juxtaposed with sort of more hard edge objects as well. So they're kind of a juxtaposition of these two things, and I think they, their titles sort of allude to this idea of the short poetry, and they're very reflective of, Noguchi's practice. I think it's also fun to think about this in light of the David Smith retrospective at LACMA and these sort of public objects, these objects that were meant to be sort of outside, that both artists were sort of working on. And then the other component of this exhibition is Noguchi's Akari light sculptures, which were made for, Noguchi represented the U.S. in the Venice Biennale in 1986, and he was really, he wanted to put in these light sculptures that he's, very well known for now. But at that time, they were quite controversial. I think his friends were really dissuading him from submitting these sculptures because they seemed more functional than fine art. And he was 80, gosh, I think he was 82 at the time. I think many people assumed that he would win the Biennale Prize because of his achievements and his age. But the Akari light sculptures were not well received, and he did not win the prize. And I think it's very interesting. You know, in my, I often say that that Noguchi was sort of ahead of his time in some ways, and he was certainly not of his time. You know, and I alluded to the fact that at this time, the LA scene was buzzing with an exhibition of Basquiat, and you know, Richard Serra's Tilted Arc was placed in New York, and all of these contentious things were sort of happening in the art scene. And mm-hmm. what Noguchi was proposing was something that was very reflective and drawing the diminishing sort of the line between function and form. And at that time, I don't think those ideas were really quite as well received. But we look at the Akari light sculptures now, and they're stunning. You know, it's these sculptural objects that hold and illuminate light. They totally alter a space. They're completely sculptural in every form, and I think, you know, and I think Noguchi's intentions perhaps are better acknowledged today than they were in 86.
Oh,
so those are the three exhibitions.
Yes, and the Akari light sculptures. My husband and I were just taken with that space. Very calm and meditative. It's almost it's very cerebral and ethereal. And,
yeah.
Wow.
It's true.
It's quite something to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also, along with Noguchi, California Legacy, you've also curated the Lita Albuquerque Emergence exhibit, which is upstairs. Tell us something about that, because that's another fascinating works.
Sure. Yeah, Lita Albuquerque has been great to work with. I initially wanted to have an exhibition that went alongside with the Noguchi exhibition. And both artists really are influenced by and by nature and sort of the ephemeral aspects of nature. And I did a studio visit with Lita, and it turns out that she was, in fact, influenced by Noguchi and had even driven him around when he was in L.A., so was like a driver for a day.
Oh, how interesting. You hadn't known that before.
I hadn't.
Oh,
so that was a really great connection there. And I was really drawn to Lita's pigment paintings. And so we had talked about, I knew that, you know, it would be in the upper space, and, you know, our conversation happened very organically, and it was really a fun moment. But the red pigment, there are two series in the exhibition. One is red pigment paintings, and the other is the Beekeeper series. And both really are quite different works, but they're quite connected. Both capture sort of elements that can't be really seen by the naked eye. And in the red pigment paintings, Lita basically blows or uses the wind to kind of lay on these red pigments onto the canvas, onto this sort of black matte canvas. And there's a really, the concentration of the red on black creates a really active color field. And the idea is that, you know, wind is not something that we're able to see, but through this process, she's able to kind of capture it. And also the many moods that wind can portray. And this very abstract idea sort of takes on almost representational images. I mean, it looks like splashing waves or sort of volcanic eruptions. There are a lot of qualities to it. So there are 16 panels, and all of them are extremely different. And then in the Beekeeper series, at the very end, we have an installation. It's basically a software that Lita Albuquerque did in collaboration with John Beasley and Chandler McWilliams. And the image begins with a beekeeper, sort of in his bee suit, holding a tray, and slowly the image of the beekeeper kind of starts to break up and pixelate, and those pixels start to sort of spread out into the space. And after a moment, it will expand to such a degree that it will look like a constellation, and it sort of seems to hang there for about a minute, and then the pixels start to come back and merge into the form of the beekeeper again. And this happens. It kind of cycles through. But the interesting thing is the pixels follow their own path, so every movement is never the same. And the idea is that it's almost a living software that will last for the duration of the exhibition. And again, this sort of very abstract idea takes on many representational images. The pixels, at one time, it looks like a form of bees buzzing around the beekeeper, and then it spreads out to look like a constellation, and then it sort of comes back. And again, sort of similar to Noguchi, it's a very meditative and a beautiful piece. And I think the thing with Lita's work, too, is she's able to bring these very metaphysical, astrological kind of connections into sort of a very modest human scale. And then we have six photographic prints where the movement of the pixels have been traced through by red lines. And over time, the pixels kind of spread out. So the images almost become a fully concentrated sort of surface of red. And that's just through the tracing of the lines of the pixels. And in that sense, it almost takes on this textured, painterly quality and connects back to sort of the red pigment paintings that that are in the first room.
Well, they both are wonderful. And how long will this exhibit run? This kind of exhibit.
Both exhibitions will go through to October 2nd. And Lita is actually giving a talk on September 18th. So it'll be really great to, get hear directly from the artist.
Oh, absolutely. And they can find more information on the website about that, because those are always wonderful when you have the curator and artist talk.
Yes, yeah.
And now you have in the fall, you have something called Best Kept Secret, which is part of Getty's Pacific Standard Time Initiative. Would you like to tell us something about that? We have about a little over 6 minutes to the end of the show.
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, it's been a really exciting project, and I just wish I had another year to work on it. So Getty's Pacific Standard Time Initiative is, there are about 60 institutions involved, and you can find out, all the partnering institutions on pacificstandardtime.org. And I think of the 60 that are all participating, doing programming and events and various things, there are 50 institutions that will have exhibitions. So it goes from Santa Barbara down to San Diego, and Orange County Museum of Art is collaborating with the Berkeley Art Museum, which is the only Bay Area institution. And it really is to look at the emergence of contemporary art and the emergence of art in Southern California from 1945 to 1980. So all of these institutions are kind of working within this sort of parameter. And Laguna Art Museum is looking at the early years of UCI from 1964, which was the inauguration of the college, but classes, you know, really started in 1965. And
okay.
Then we end, yeah, and then we end in 1971. And, you know, really, UCI is very, very interesting for, you know, another 10 years following, but it would mean, you know, we would require, you know, three times the space of our museum and certainly a lot more research. But we wanted to focus on the early years because the archives are still not all that great. There's still a lot of fuzzy areas. There's a lot of mythology around these years, and there are sort of quite some unknowns. So part of it is to kind of figure that out. And, you know, it really stemmed from Clayton Garrison was the dean of the fine arts during this time, and he hired John Copeland, who was one of the founders of Art Forum magazine, to head the university art gallery. And from there, Tony DeLapp was in the Bay Area teaching at UC Davis at the time, and was recruited to come to UCI and teach. And the art department really grew into an amazing faculty that included Ed Burrell, Ed Moses, Larry Bell, Ron Davis, Laddie John Dill, Via Selmans, on and on. It was just a really sort of an amazing group of faculty members and visiting lecturers. David Hockney was there for a period of time. Frank Stella was had agreed to sign on, but then he didn't want to sign the loyalty oath. And at the time, he was married to Barbara Rose, who was an art historian and an art critic. So she came on to teach. And then during that time, a wealth of students sort of came on that really pushed the boundaries of all of these movements that were happening. And you know, we had Alexis Smith and Chris Burden, Charles Hill, Jay McCafferty, on and on. I could just go on. But we have about, in the exhibition, we'll be showing about 38 artists. And there will be a publication that really is more about looking at that time period. And we decided to end in 1971, because John Copeland then leaves for New York, and Barbara Rose and Myra Roth start the Duchamp Festival, which was kind of a multidisciplinary sort of involvement at UCI, looking at Duchamp's contributions to contemporary art. And then 1971 was also the corporation of the city of Irvine. So I thought it was a really interesting moment to look at the fact that there was this enormous activity all before the city's actual incorporation.
Well, it sounds really, you know, terrific. And when will that open? What are the dates for that particular exhibit?
That exhibition opens October 30th, and it will go through January 29th, I want to say.
And I would imagine there's all sorts of festivities at the museum around the event, and you'll be publicizing those activities.
Yeah, we'll have pretty ambitious programming during that time. And December 4th and 5th, Pacific Standard Time is focusing on the South region, so Orange County, Long Beach and Orange County. And so there'll be some added activities for that'll focus on Orange County during that time.
Well, I'd love for our listeners to be able to get in touch with you, Grace. So if there's you know, a website or a telephone number that you'd like to share before we have to close for today.
Yeah, that would be great. People can just go on our website, lagunaartmuseum.org, and you can send emails, and all our information is on there.
Oh, terrific. Is there a telephone number you'd like to share, too? Or?
Sure. Our phone number is area code 949-494-8971. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. I think we're on Twitter and MySpace and all of that, so you can follow us there, too.
Oh, terrific. This has been just wonderful, Grace, to have you on and to speak about Noguchi and Lita Albuquerque and the Best Kept Secret. Very much look forward to that exhibit upcoming, and also need to go back down and take another look at Noguchi and Lita Albuquerque, because, first time round you see, certain aspects of the exhibit, and you need to kind of go back to get more of the perspective. So I want to thank you very much. It's been very much a pleasure to have you join me today.
Thanks, Susan. It's been really great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll have to have you on again as we get closer to Best Kept Secret, definitely. And
you can tell us more about that, and
maybe even have a longer show where we can talk more in depth about that, because 38 artists, that's a lot, and it sounds like a very, very interesting time period. I've heard a little bit about that. I was not in Orange County at the time, but it sounds, quite progressive and energetic, and, certainly a very kind of time-changing time. So Creative Orange County is the radio show is part of Creative Orange County, which is a think tank at the intersection of culture, commerce, and community in Orange County, California. And if you'd like more information, please visit us at www.creativeorangecounty.com. And please email me at creativeorangecounty@hotmail.com if you'd like to recommend an Orange County Creative Star, someone for me to interview, or if you have project ideas. For collaborations, partnerships and collaborations to inspire and engage Orange County's creative community. Until next week, thank you again.